the talk, which I have to say is preliminary. I say that for all my talks, but this one in particular, largely because these are the topic of today's talk is something that I sort of encountered as a topic of interest when doing research for this book on courtly culture, and it's something that I've begun to explore, but by no means have explored sufficiently. I mean, for any of you who know anything about, which I'm sure many of you do, about Sanskrit literature, it is a vast, vast topic. The term Subhashita invokes a huge literature, one which is ever expanding in some ways to this very day, and is not properly documented, which is an interesting point, which I think I'll touch on. But I've located this interest within thinking about trying to write the history of ethics in early India. Not that one I could have so much hubris as to pretend to write anything like a comprehensive history of ethics, but simply to approach ethics from a historical point of view. That is my real interest. And that raises a number of thorny methodological and theoretical questions about dealing with early Indian materials, and in fact dealing with the frameworks with which we used to look at early Indian materials, which have preoccupied me in some ways more than the Subhashita itself. So in some ways, the paper that you're going to hear doesn't have as much about Subhashita as it does about how one could approach Subhashitas. I'll ask your forgiveness for that. But partly, I don't feel too apologetic because it is a topic which is so vast, and many of you here may have more experience in dealing with Subhashitas than I myself do, and so I would submit what I do have to say with the humility of learning something from the audience as well. Now, I would say that in some ways, I kept getting the feeling when I was writing this paper that I was, you know, spending a lot of ink stating something that was amazingly obvious, that Subhashitas are about ethics. Well, that's not saying very much, I suppose, because we all know and have been told for generations that, in fact, Subhashitas are collections of worldly wisdom. But I think that doesn't actually say enough about what Subhashitas are. And so I think by the end of this paper, I hope that I will have made a series of more pointed observations about how we could understand Subhashitas as ethical statements, and not only that, how we might fit those ethical statements into a larger framework of understanding ethics in early India. So, having said that, I'll begin. And I should begin, I suppose, by just sort of trying to set out what I mean by the term ethics. Ethics and morality, to talk about these topics is no small task, and I'm hardly a philosopher. I've mostly relied on other philosophers and renditions of their work. But I think that there are some useful distinctions made by philosophers which can help us make useful distinctions in looking at the early Indian material. Now, if we follow recent thinkers, I think it's possible to make a general distinction between two types of moral or ethical practice. One may begin with a simple distinction laid out by Bernard Williams in his Ethics and the Limits of Philosophy. Williams defines ethics very broadly as the answer we give to the general question of how one ought to live. Morality, on the other hand, for Williams, is concerned with a far more limited provenance and should be understood as one kind of ethical activity, the volitional choice to obey or disobey, to do good or evil. There are different versions of this problem, according to Williams, but they all center around the moral decision to do right or wrong in light of stipulated human obligations. Morality revolves around whether and how one conforms to this obligation. So in William's formulation, morality is a set of very restricted and ultimately diminished concerns in relation to the wider ethical question of how one ought to live. Williams, as a philosopher, was concerned from the vantage point of the ethical subject. Another philosopher I've found quite inspirational in this regard is Michel Foucault in his later work, who took up the topic of ethics, but from a more historical point of view. In the second volume of his unfinished History of Sexuality, Foucault claimed to be writing a genealogy of ethics in the West. Foucault did not, like Williams, draw a distinction between ethics and morality. He did, however, distinguish between what he called code-based moralities and ethics-based moralities. In code-oriented moralities, moral rules were elaborately specified and socially established and enforced. What Foucault called ethics-oriented moralities, however, were primarily concerned with the types of relationship that a person was to have with himself. This was not simply self-awareness, or gnosis, or whatever one might call it, but the process of self-formation as an ethical subject, what he called subjectivation or subjectivization. The emphasis here was the ways in which an individual became a subject of ethical conduct, rather than on conduct alone. How one made oneself the object of moral practice took up a particular stance toward the precepts or rules one followed. According to Foucault, in ethics-oriented moralities, individuals were encouraged not so much to follow a rule, but to become a certain kind of person. So we end up with a conception not so far away from that of Williams. The distinction drawn by both Williams and Foucault are not by any means to be seen as mutually exclusive from one another. Code-oriented and ethics-oriented moralities could exist within a single historical configuration. Indeed, they are to some extent presuppose one another. Their changing relationships is what Foucault sought to explore in his History of Sexuality. Indeed, while discussing the topic of marriage in the Hellenic world, Foucault made the important observation that while moral codes in the form of injunctions and interdictions might appear to have remained stable over time, modes of subjectivization, the ways moral subjects were enjoined to follow these rules, changed dramatically. This, I think, is particularly important to keep in mind in relation to the generally dehistoricized Indian setting. And I'll come back to that, because I think there's a very interesting and important example from early India. There is, of course, a polemic which informs this scholarship. Williams and Foucault, as well as other thinkers as diverse as Alistair MacIntyre and Geoffrey Minson, have variously sought to enter into some dialogue with and ultimately rehabilitate ethical traditions which were dominant before the rise of Enlightenment humanism. Their polemic has often been directly or implicitly directed against the towering figure of modern humanist and rationalist ethics, Immanuel Kant. Kant asserted that what was properly ethical was ideal, universal, and rational. That is, it applied to all humans, regardless of their social status, in all situations, regardless of any particularity, and most importantly, was sanctioned by the a priori presence of universal and moral imperatives that resided within human rationality itself. According to Kant, ethical practice formed an inner domain of man's being, standing in opposition to and ultimately transcending its outside, the particular situations which any human moral agent faced in real life. Though ethical decisions were to inform and determine individual action within the social world presented itself to the ethical rationality merely as a set of variables to which it applied a moral imperative. Kant's interventions, importantly, were not simply neutral demarcations, but were themselves polemics against various traditions of prehumanist ethics, which he sought to exclude from the ambit of what was properly ethical. Prehumanist, particularist ethical systems, in which not all men, and dare I say women, were subject to the same moral codes, were obviously anathema for Kant. But other forms of prehumanist ethical practice, which did not take the form of volitional choice vis-a-vis right and wrong, like ascetical practices, manners, etiquette, and most importantly, perhaps, rhetoric were all equally problematic. According to Kant, though rhetoric and manners played some role in the development of real virtue, they could not be considered virtues in and of themselves. Quote, affability, politeness, refinement, propriety, courtesy, and ingratiating and captivating behavior call for no large measure of moral determination and therefore cannot be reckoned as virtues. Unquote. The triumph of Kantian enlightened ethics was, of course, part of a much wider historical defeat, both institutionally and ideologically, of ancient regimes in Europe and the cultural practices associated with them. Indeed, the humanist critique of pre-Enlightenment ethical systems turned precisely on their association with the purportedly duplicitous and tyrannical features of aristocratic and ecclesiastical institutions. A series of related historical and ideological developments in Europe, the rise of print media, capitalist classes, liberal ideas of enlightened self-interest, and new concepts of political contract, all variously helped to dismantle the religious and socio-political institutions which had supported pre-humanist ethical systems. If we may use the sociological arguments of the Enlightenment against itself, that is, where manners and rhetoric were connected inevitably to hierarchies of slave and feudal societies, then it is perhaps significant that the triumph of Kant's interiorization of ethical practice and his apotheosis of altruism as the marker of authentically ethical behavior or ethical thought occurred at the very same time that public institutions were bureaucratically rationalized and that the public pursuit of individual self-interest became the ideological cornerstone of liberal society. In other words, the interiorization, universalization, and simplification of ethics in post-Kantian morality must be seen in the context of the surrender or perhaps realignment of large parts of human activity in both individual and collective institutional life to principles which would actually seem to undercut them. Most troublingly for thinkers like Williams, McIntyre, Foucault, and Minson, as well as others, the triumph of Kantian ethics has been tantamount to a great diminishment and attenuation of ethical concern, almost to the point of an idealistic irrelevancy. Minson puts the issue poignantly, though it is possible to legislate against something like sexual harassment in the workplace, the boundaries of what can be classified as genuinely harassment remain imprecise and therefore inadequately addressed by law. On the other hand, according to Minson, we have no recourse to any developed ethical language within the Kantian framework which would help men and women become better workers with one another, except, of course, the individual's interior application of a universal moral imperative which operates, it should be noted, within a framework no less legalistic than that of the state itself, but one which is largely silent and inaccessible. The only realms of our public life which retain a faint resonance of the world of pre-humanistic ethical traditions, it could be argued, are activities like going to the gym, sitting in therapy, taking anger management courses, reading self-help books, activities, indeed hobbies, fit for singles advertisements or even a resume, but almost entirely devoid of any serious ethical content. Pale shadows of a world gone by. Thinking about ethics in this sort of world has been the motivation for thinkers like Minson and Foucault to turn more seriously to the pre-humanistic ethical traditions. What, you may be wondering, does the rather overlong discussion above of European ethics have to do with the topic of today's lecture, Subhashitas and ethical traditions in India? The point I would make very baldly and simply is that because of the historical developments in the South Asian subcontinent over the last 200 years, this history also now belongs to India in at least two senses. First, the growth of modern institutions in India, like print media, schools, and civil society, the constitutional state, and a modern capitalist economy, however incomplete, hybrid, fragmentary, etc., ensured the reality of processes not altogether different from those outlined above, processes which saw the gradual erosion and transformation of pre-colonial cultural practices, including ethical traditions. Second, the development of these institutions and their fallout, whether in colonial state policy, indigenous reform movements, or academic writing on the Indian traditions, have all relied upon certain polemical representations and conceptions of the pre-colonial past in India, including an assessment of the content of its various ethical traditions. While the ideological sharpness of some of these characterizations has surely faded, their aura still persists in our own interpretive frameworks. This means that in order to understand the scope and history of ethics in pre-colonial India in any effective manner, one cannot help but engage with this interpretive legacy. And incidentally, I believe that this is, you know, it is only through a proper historical understanding of pre-colonial ethical practice that it will be possible to understand the potentials and limits of their persistence, reoccupation, and their utility in contemporary Indian life. This is another matter, however, but a very interesting one. How then can one make any contribution to the history of ethics in pre-colonial India? Typically, approaches have focused on the changing content of values and prescriptions as embodied in shastras, or katha, or vinaya literature, to take three examples, what may be loosely called code-based moralities, in Foucault's terminology. This, of course, is very useful. It is possible to indicate the historical emergence of doctrines, let's say, of devotion or nonviolence. Scholars of religion, particularly scholars of Buddhism and theistic Hinduism, have also very usefully examined the philosophical discourses about morals and ethics. Here, we see a concern more with what Foucault called ethics-based moralities. Again, this work has been very important. There are still, however, many unanswered questions, particularly in light of the recent scholarship on ethics I've mentioned above. One point which clearly needs consideration is widening the frame of what is considered as ethics in the first place. That is, to use Williams' framework, to return ethics to its larger question of how it is that one should live. Anthropologists, and I have in mind here James Laidlaw's wonderful book, Riches and Renunciation, have long recognized, but others as well, that indigenous Indian ethical thinking has a strong, if not dominant, particularist component. This particularism, however, led to multiple foci of ethical practice. One point of concentration should be to delineate basic types and locales of ethical practice: the court, the monastery, the agraharam, the twice-born or noble household, the market, the Sufi khanqa, form distinct, though sometimes and often overlapping, arenas for the articulation of ethical practice. Some ethical doctrines were universalist and others particularist, but most combined some form of both. Another important realm of concern for the historian of ethics in India is the form with which ethical discourses could take. In pre-colonial India, these may have included not only Shastra, but Vinaya, Naya, Natya, Niti, Akhyayika in Sanskrit, or Tariq, Akhlaqi, or Mofuz in Persian. The types of ethical practice within and between these genres, even when in agreement over prescription and interdiction, varied considerably. When we put these concerns into a historical frame, it is possible to chart a more nuanced history of ethics than has hitherto been done. The profound transition in ethical practice which took place in early historic India, for example, as Vedic sacrificial practices were slowly disarticulated with the rise of ascetical religious orders, was one which not only occurred at the level of positive content of ethical norms, okay, but more profoundly, perhaps, in the ways in which humans were encouraged to relate themselves to these ethical norms, or what Foucault called modes of ethical subjectivity. So while certain moral prescriptions may have remained in place during these changes, the ways that men and women inhabited these prescriptions changed radically. I have in mind here doctrines of karma and rebirth, intentionality and merit accumulation, which encouraged an entirely new set of relationships that the moral subject was to have with codes and rules, and most particularly with himself. Relationships further transformed by theistic texts like the Bhagavad Gita, which many of you would be very aware of. My particular interest in Subhashita literature has arisen from my research on early medieval India, which has sought most generally to rethink various types of sources as parts of a distinctive courtly worldview. My contention has been that many spheres of knowledge previously understood as part of some generalized ancient Indian society would be better associated with the particular dynamics of the royal court and its ancillary institutions. I have also suggested that this world had a distinctive ethical tradition. This is particularly so if we define ethics, following Williams and Foucault, as an answer to the question of how one ought to live. Courtly traditions of cultivation and refinement were not strictly separated, either conceptually or sociologically, from other domains of ethical practice, including the more familiar code-based moralities associated with the Dharmashastra or Vyavahara, for example. Rather, they seem to have fulfilled a somewhat different purpose. Insofar as courtly ethics did take the form of Shastra, they suggest that Shastra was capable of quite a diverse ethical meaning. That is to say, that while parts of the Shastra were systematic, rigid, and even brutal, particularly those which safeguarded and differentiated the privileges of the ruling classes from those below them, functioning in a quasi-juridical manner, elsewhere, Shastra served instead to constitute ethical subjects. They enjoined men to take diverse and considered relationships to the interdictions and rules of Dharma. So if we look at the Kama Sutra and the Arthashastra, for example, we see that they're concerned less with rules and codes than with advice on how to properly negotiate oneself within a field of morally sanctioned activity, considering the network of allowances and prohibitions known from Dharma. The ethical content of these texts, often taken to be amoral, instrumental, or Machiavellian, which are terms that come up again and again and again in introductions to these texts, would better be seen as encouraging an ethics-based morality in the sense outlined by Foucault. I believe that the primary features of courtly ethics, then, were two. First, a preoccupation with the acquisition and disposition of virtues as an ethical practice in and of itself. And secondly, a close association of aesthetics and moral life. Significantly, courtly discourses were concerned neither with outlining a universal human moral faculty nor with making moral judgments, the sine qua non of ethical life. And I have in mind here the Kantian notion of ethical subjectivity. Instead, it was the acquisition of moral qualities or virtues, encapsulated in the Sanskrit term guna, which formed the goal of a properly lived life. This perhaps explains the preponderance in both eulogistic and didactic literature with the enumeration of lists of virtues appropriate to men of different classes, ranks, and functions, both within and beyond the nobility. People of noble rank were to acquire and exhibit these virtues as badges of their rank, birth, and moral eminence. Here, courtly ethics was both socially ascriptive and agentive and universalist. The inclination towards certain qualities was surely given by birth, but their actualization was only due, could only happen through human effort. Courtly discourses stress again and again that neither birth nor cultivation was enough. The common metaphor was that of a gem or a precious stone, which unpolished and unrefined could hardly shine with virtue. While some virtues were fit for particular ranks and stations, others were to be cultivated by all members at court. A stock set of virtues is mentioned in medieval copperplate charters to describe princes, samantas, mantrins alike. They included prudent policy, naya, humility, vinaya, compassion, daya, generosity, dana, politeness, dakshinya, valor, shaurya, magnanimity, audarya, and truthfulness, satya. I mean, you get this list again and again and again in inscriptions. Much more could be said about the cultivation of these virtues, not least of which is about their, one could say much about their public cultivation and ascertainment as the basis for employment and advancement at court. Of course, these are the very reasons that Kant would have disallowed such cultivation from the authentically ethical, because this submitted them to some sort of practical use. But this need not concern us here for the moment. I only want to stress that it is the acquisition and disposition of virtue itself that formed the key activity of ethical conduct, not the judgment of right and wrong, as we have in the Kantian notion of ethics. Ratiocinative activity and collective moral introspection tended to occur over how best to bring virtues together and to order them correctly. What might be considered a refinement of character. And there's so many, and one reads the inscriptions, there's so many descriptions of how it is that a refined person can make humility temper their pride, or to make you, in fact, one thinks of Shemendra's Darpa Dalana, the a treatise he wrote in which each chapter is takes a moral virtue and basically attacks it as a vice, because any moral virtue could become a vice unless a moral virtue was tempered by the moral virtue of Vinaya or humility. So this is a very interesting. So what it is to be a moral person is to arrange and interrelate the various virtues that one accumulates in a proper fashion. The other key characteristic of courtly ethics was their persistent linkage with aesthetics. Indeed, the acquisition of virtues was deemed a decoration of the soul. And the most common metaphor used to describe such self-cultivation was the ornamentation and beautification of the self. Aesthetic enjoyment itself was educative and instructive of the moral content of the system, as well as being a positively valued ethical activity. Moral achievement and aesthetic sophistication were isomorphic. Typical here again is the idea that arrangement of virtues within oneself in proper relation to one another was essentially a beautification of one's character. Soma Devasuri, a Jain writer on Niti, says that modesty is the ornament of prowess. Again, much more could be said here, but I'd like now to turn more specifically to the role of Subhashitas in this formulation as I've laid it out. How am I doing on time? Okay. Yeah? I want now to turn to the specific sort of literature in India which I think occupied a central place in the life at court, and whose shape and history tells us something important about ethical life among the educated classes. I have in mind here what is called Subhashita or Sukti in Sanskrit, with the sense of well-spoken or beautifully said. These terms refer to short, standalone verses which express some moral principle or notable situation in particularly apt or pleasing fashion, either through poetic virtuosity, density, or density of expression or example. They could be, as Ludwig Sternbach has pointed out, either sententious or purely descriptive and evocative, with no apparent didactic content. The regular use of these terms to denote such verses dates to the first centuries of the Christian era, but the phenomena itself of single aphoristic verses seems to be a feature of Indian literate culture from its very inception. In fact, the very breadth of Sanskrit literature echoes with such verses. They seem to have formed part of nearly every conceivable genre of Sanskrit, from Kavya, Itihasa, Purana, to Shastra. Large numbers of verses are found in the Mahabharata, Savitri Parvan, and some later Dharma, and particularly Niti Shastras, tended to be composed almost entirely in such sententious and extractable verses. Though the Subhashita as a form certainly constituted a feature of the earliest strata of India, earliest strata of Sanskrit and Prakrit literatures, it was not until the first centuries of the Christian era that this literature came to be understood as a separate genre in need of collection and anthologization. The early collections, whether the verse anthologies compiled by Hala or those attributed to the enigmatic figures of Chanakya or Bhartahari, together mark a serious change in the importance and treatment of this literature. I want to return to this point, but it will suffice for the moment to say that the rise of anthologies seems to strikingly parallel the crystallization of court culture I have mentioned above, with its distinctive ethical traditions. The process seems to have accelerated greatly from the 9th century, when numerous anthologies of either singly authored verses or heterogeneous and anonymous verses were assembled by various authors and compilers. According to Sternbach's magisterial survey, very large numbers of anthologies survived from the 17th century and continue to be compiled into the 20th. And the explanation for this is something which I think, you know, is yet to be satisfactorily dealt with. These more famous and widespread anthologies, and I'm talking about Chanakya's anthologies and Bhartahari's, were subject to ongoing imitation and supplementation by authors and scribes, creating a truly bewildering array of versions, recensions, and imitations of these key texts. While this is surely enough to drive the textual critic to the brink, Sternbach recognized the very important fact that the authors of these texts had access to a living tradition of Subhashitas with which they freely supplemented the texts before them. In addition to anthologies, hundreds of Subhashitas were also incorporated into the didactic story literature, like the Panchatantra, the Hitopadesha, Kathasaritsagara, and others, where they were placed into the mouths of characters at opportune moments of moral reflection and teaching. As Sternbach painstakingly demonstrated, the verse portions of these prose works formed the occasion for subsequent authors, copyists, and scribes through the generations to add and embellish in the same way that later readers added to the anthologies they learned and preserved. The importance of this literature for reconstructing the positive ethical content of the courtly classes and beyond, as some later anthologies were surely compiled outside the courtly milieu, is inestimable. Many of the descriptive verses embody the thematic obsessions of educated and aristocratic life, love, the seasons, war, humorous characters in the king's court, etc., as well as preserving particularly valued aesthetic principles. The more didactic verses, on the other hand, present us with an explicitly or indirectly stated advice of hundreds of named and nameless courtly intellectuals on diverse topics, from royal service to the importance of birth, misery, poverty, the proper disposal of wealth, to thoughts about particular virtues and vices, as well as a host of other subjects. Ultimately, a strong distinction between the literary, descriptive, and the moral didactic verses is perhaps not to be drawn, although Sternbach does in fact draw this, as many of the anthologies include both together, though it has to be said others do not. At a more elementary level, all didactic verses had some poetic force, and all descriptive verses were invested with some world of value. While some anthologies organize themselves under the rubrics of the four goals of human existence or the threefold path of worldly life, which we're all familiar with, most were organized into topical chapters for easy reference. It seems that the focus of most didactic literature, on the other hand, was on niti or policy, a term only distantly related to statecraft from the imperial point of view, as seen in the Arthashastra, but which largely replaces it with a more decentered advice literature for a wider society of educated nobles and elites, all of whom benefited from knowledge about conducting one's career among the good. The change in form from sutra to the more epigrammatic and gnomic verse style of the literature on Artha is seen in Nitisara, and is emblematic of the changes that I'm talking about. This text is sometimes dated in the immediate post-Gupta era of the 6th to 7th centuries, although that's not a certain date by any means. I myself, and no doubt many others, have dipped into the surface, however superficially, of the vast anthologized Subhashita literature to glimpse some of the main themes of this courtly world. One point which anyone even vaguely familiar with this literature will know, however, is that the anthologies do not preserve a single set of moral standpoints. In fact, Subhashitas often take positions of variance and distinction on a single topic of reflection, like the relative importance of a particular virtue or vice, or the sublimities or dangers of enjoying women. Together, these topical clusters indicate the coalescence or condensation of ethical wisdom and reflection on certain domains of ethical inquiry, not a single set of judgments, or not a single judgment about an ethical problem. But as may be clear by now, perhaps the most important feature, from my perspective, of this literature for reconstructing the history of ethics in medieval India is its form. The Subhashita, or well-spoken verse, as all commentators have recognized, was produced in a highly oral environment, what Sternbach famously called the floating mass of oral tradition. I always sort of think of a large rootless tree shaking off floating in the air, shaking dirt everywhere. The obvious question, as this was hardly an illiterate and popular or uneducated world, is what relation this orality had to literary production in general, and for our purposes, to ethical self-cultivation. David Shulman and Veltro Narayana Rao, in their fascinating study of what they call remembered verses from early modern South India, are certainly correct to assert that these verses constitute the living breath of literature in medieval India and constituted a distinctive social space between text-literate production and its everyday reception and circulation. They perhaps overstate their case, I think, when they posit a strong distinction between an apparently entirely oral and dynamic world. They use the term chatu, or a term meaning flattery or well-constructed verse, essentially perhaps synonymous with subhashita, pleasing verse. And they assert that there's a strong distinction between an oral dynamic world of the chatu and the entire tradition of anthologized subhashitas that I've been talking about so far in this essay. I would contest this for a number of reasons, most notably that the examples they give in the book are usually from published anthologies and not modern published anthologies, in some cases anthologies that go back to the 15th century. Indeed, some of their prime examples of this pristine oral textuality come from anthologies known to have been compiled in pre-colonial times. The anthologization of verses was not an ossification and paralysis of a pristine oral literary world, but a moment in the continued renewal and transmission and circulation of this open-ended knowledge, where compilers sought to harness this material for immediate and future use, not philological antiquarianism. I think what he has in mind, what both of these scholars have in mind when they say that anthologization kills this tradition, is the collections of proverbs and maxims by colonial officials like C.P. Brown and a few others. They're working mostly with Telugu materials, but this, they feel, kills the vibrant oral tradition of literary practice. I would suggest that it's a lot more than just these anthologizers that are killing that literary practice. There's a lot of other historical developments happening at the same time. That actually indicting these subhashitas is not, in fact, tantamount to destroying their orality. It's, in a certain sense, as I say, a moment of preservation and recirculation of this oral literate world back into itself. So this explains the apparent disregard for the textual integrity of received anthologies by scribes and transmitters, that the fact that they're not philologists. The anthology was meant to facilitate the circulation of wisdom among the elite and thus served as an important function in sustaining the literary oral world of the elite. The cross-borrowing and accretive nature of literary anthologies suggests that as a knowledge form, the subhashita tradition was highly dialogical. We have numerous cases where the first half of a subhashita verse, expressing a moral maxim, is largely preserved in many different versions, in which the final verse is completed differently by various poets. One of the verses adduced by Narayana Rao and Shulman as indicative of this pristine oral literary circulation is in fact a rendition of one such verse compiled in a literate anthology sometime not long after the 15th century by Vallabhadeva. The string of verses all begin with the maximum that anything spoken at an opportune time, avasarapatitam sarvam, becomes well spoken, even though it may not in fact be well spoken, asuktamapi, or may have, or have any good qualities at all, gunagana rahitapi. In each case, however, the second half of the verse differs. In one case, the poet says, at the moment of hunger, even a worthless piece of food will be tasty. While another says that when beginning a journey, even the shriek of a chasha bird becomes auspicious. And yet another, this is the one cited by Narayana Rao and Shulman, that at the moment of lovemaking, even the absence of ornaments can become a decoration for a woman's body. all attempt to capture more pithily than the other the spirit of the maximum about which, I mean, sorry, the spirit of the maxim about the importance of timing. Such poems, of which there are very many, dispersed across various anthologies, suggest that poets composed in dialogue with one another and with the tradition itself. Indeed, the prevalence of riddles and verse completion contests, what's known in Sanskrit as Samasya Puranam, included among the arts to be mastered by the urbane and courtly man as early as the 4th century, and narrativized in the famous works like Prabandha Chintamani and Bhoja Prabandha, give us a very clear indication of the sociology of such exchange and dialogue. Learned men valued the ability to interact with one another by citing such verses in the course of conversation as they became relevant, interrupting one another, finishing verses, and playing various types of verbal games. Each subhashita cited became the occasion for further elaboration and response by the listener. While in the depiction of the royal court, such exchanges were often displays of poetic virtuosity alone, in the katha literature, they were often used to make substantive points in moral and important dialogues about ethical issues which face characters in the story. So in the Panchatantra, when Karataka and Damanaka, the two jackals, are faced with the problem of how to advance at court, their dialogue is peppered with verses cited to one another in support or critique of their own strategies. This, I would submit, shows the Subhashita tradition in action. To sum up, from the point of view of understanding the history of ethics in South Asia, then, the verse anthologies become valuable on two levels. First, they encode positive content of courtly ethics, the array of virtues which populated the ethical universe of the elite, and the ways in which they should be deployed in relation to one another. Like other courtly sources, they present us with a conception of moral life largely at odds with our own, where a vast domain of concerns and activities now deemed ethically inconsequential or irrelevant were the object of sustained scrutiny and reflection. As beautifully turned poetry, they link the vast world of courtly aesthetics to this world of virtue. But more than this, Subhashitas represent the surviving traces of the actual processes of moral subjectivization, to come back to Foucault, the manner in which individuals came to understand themselves as moral subjects, as agents within the ethical framework of this ethical world. The important feature of the Subhashita anthologies, over and above their moral content, their positions regarding proper arrangement of virtues within oneself then, was the fact that they were the means through which men refined their ethical sensibilities through reflection and debate. Thank you.